think about was that neat stack of body parts. No blood. None at all. Chapter 7. This body is stretched out just the way I like it. The arms and legs are secure and the mouth is stopped with duct tape, so there will be no noise and no spill into my work area. And my hand feels so steady with the knife that I am quite sure this will be a good one, very satisfying. Except it's not a knife, it's some kind of... Except it's not my hand. Even though my hand is moving with this hand, it's not mine that holds the blade. And the room really is sort of small. It's so narrow, which makes sense because it's... What? And now here I am floating above this perfect, tight workspace and its tantalizing body, and for the first time I feel the cold blowing around me and even through me somehow. And if I could only feel my teeth, I am quite sure they would chatter. And my hand, in perfect unison with that other hand, goes up and arches back for a perfect cut. And of course I wake up in my apartment, standing somehow by the front door completely naked. Sleepwalking I could understand, but sleep stripping? Really? I stumble back to my little trundle bed. The covers are in a heap on the floor. The air conditioner has kicked the temperature down close to 60. It had seemed like a good idea at the time, last night, feeling a little estranged from it all after what had happened with Rita. Preposterous, if it had really happened. Dexter the love bandit, stealing kisses. And so I had taken a long, hot shower when I got home, and shoved the thermostat all the way down as I climbed into bed. I don't pretend to understand why, but in my darker moments I find cold cleansing, not refreshing so much as necessary. And cold it was. Far too cold now, for coffee and the start of the day amid the last tattered pieces of the dream. As a rule, I don't remember my dreams, and don't attach any importance to them if I do. So it was ridiculous that this one was staying with me. Floating above this perfect, tight workspace, my hand in perfect unison with that other hand goes up and arches back for a perfect cut. I've read the books. Perhaps because I'll never be one, humans are interesting to me, so I know all the symbolism. Floating is a form of flying, meaning sex, and the knife.
Ja, Herr Doktor, the knife ist ein Mother, ja?
Snap out of it, Dexter. Just a stupid, meaningless dream. The telephone rang, and I almost jumped out of my skin.
How about breakfast at Wolfie's? Said Deborah. My treat.
It's Saturday morning, I said. We'll never get in.
I'll get there first and get a table, she said. Meet you there.
Wolfie's Deli on Miami Beach was a Miami tradition, and because the Morgans are a Miami family, we had been eating there all our lives on those special deli occasions. Why Deborah thought today might be one of those occasions was beyond me, but I was sure she would enlighten me in time. So I took a shower, dressed in my casual Saturday best, and drove out to the beach. Traffic was light over the new improved MacArthur Causeway, and soon I was politely elbowing my way through the teeming throngs at Wolfie's. True to her word, Deborah had corralled a corner table. She was chatting with an ancient waitress, a woman even I recognized. Rose, my love, I said, bending to kiss her wrinkled cheek. She turned her permanent scowl on me. My wild Irish Rose.
Dexter, she rasped, with her thick Middle European accent. Knock off with the kiss like some Fagala.
Fagala, is that Irish for fiancé? I asked her, and slid into my chair.
Fe,
she said, trudging off to the kitchen and shaking her head at me. I think she likes me, I told Deborah.
Somebody should, said Deb. How was your date last night?
A lot of fun, I said. You should try it sometime.
Fe,
said Deborah. You can't spend all your nights standing on Tamiami Trail in your underwear, Deb. You need a life.
I need a transfer, she snarled at me, to Homicide Bureau. Then we'll see about a life.
I understand, I said. It would certainly sound better for the kids to say mommy's in homicide.
Dexter, for Christ's sake, she said.
It's a natural thought, Deborah. Nephews and nieces, more little Morgans, why not? She blew out a long breath.
I thought Mom was dead, she said. I'm channeling her, I said, through the cherry Danish. Well, change the channel. What do you know about cell crystallization? I blinked. Wow, I said. You just blew away all the competition in the subject-changing tournament. I'm serious, she said. Then I really am floored, Deb. What do you mean, cell crystallization? From cold, she said. Cells that have crystallized from cold. Light flooded my brain. Of course, I said. Beautiful. And somewhere deep inside, small bells began to ring. Cold. Clean, pure cold. And the cool knife almost sizzling as it slices into the warm flesh. Antiseptic clean coldness. The blood slowed and helpless. So absolutely right and totally necessary. Cold. Why didn't I started to say. I shut up when I saw Deborah's face. What? Deb demanded. What, of course? I shook my head. First tell me why you want to know. She looked at me for a long, hard moment and blew out another breath. I think you know, she said at last. There's been another murder. I know, I said. I passed it last night. I heard you didn't actually pass it. I shrugged. Metro Dade is such a small family. So what did that of course mean? Nothing, I said, mildly irritated at last. The flesh of the body just looked a little different. If it was subjected to cold, I held out my hands, that's all, okay? How cold? Like meatpacking cold, she said. Why would he do that? Because it's beautiful, I thought. It would slow the flow of blood, I said. She studied me. Is that important? I took a long and perhaps slightly shaky breath. Not only could I never explain it, she would lock me up if I tried. It's vital, I said. For some reason, I felt embarrassed. Why vital? I don't know. I think he has a thing about blood, Deb. Just a feeling I got from, I don't know, no evidence, you know. She was giving me that look again. I tried to think of something to say, but I couldn't. Glib, silver-tongued Dexter, with a dry mouth and nothing to say. Shit, she said at last. That's it? Cold slows the blood. And that's vital? Come on, what the hell good is that, Dexter? I don't do good before coffee, Deborah, I said with a heroic effort at recovery. Just accurate. Shit, she said again. Rose brought our coffee. Deborah sipped. Last night, I got an invite to the 72-hour briefing, she said. I clapped my hands. Wonderful! You've arrived! What do you need me for? Metro Dade has a policy of pulling the homicide team together approximately 72 hours after a murder. The investigating officer and her team talk it over with the medical examiner and sometimes someone from the prosecutor's office. It keeps everyone on the same heading. If Deborah had been invited, she was on the case. She scowled. I'm not good at politics, Dexter. I can feel LaGuerta pushing me out, but I can't do anything about it. Is she still looking for her mystery witness? Deborah nodded. Really? Even after the new kill last night? She says that proves it, because the new cuts were all complete. But they were all different, I protested. She shrugged. And you suggested? Deb looked away. I told her I thought it was a waste of time to look for a witness when it was obvious that the killer wasn't interrupted, just unsatisfied. Ouch, I said. You really don't know anything about politics. Well, goddammit, Dex, she said. Two old ladies at the next table glared at her. She didn't notice. What you said made sense. It is obvious, and she's ignoring me, and even worse. What could be worse than being ignored, I said. She blushed. I caught a couple of the uniforms snickering at me afterward. There's a joke going around, and I'm it. She bit her lip and looked away. Einstein, she said. I'm afraid I don't get it. If my tits were brains, I'd be Einstein, she said bitterly. I cleared my throat instead of laughing. That's what she's spreading about me, Deb went on. That kind of crappy little tag sticks to you, and then they don't promote you because they think nobody will respect you with a nickname like that. God damn it, Dex, she said again. She's ruining my career. I felt a little surge of protective warmth. She's an idiot. Should I tell her that, Dex? Would that be political?
Our food arrived. Rose slammed the plates down in front of us as though she had been condemned by a corrupt judge to serve breakfast to baby killers. I gave her a gigantic smile, and she trudged away, muttering to herself. I took a bite and turned my thoughts to Deborah's problem. I had to try to think of it that way, Deborah's problem. Not those fascinating murders, not that amazingly attractive M.O., or the thing so similar to what I would love to do someday. I had to stay uninvolved, but this was pulling at me so very hard. Even last night's dream with its cold air. Pure coincidence, of course, but unsettling anyway. This killer had touched the heart of what my killing was about. In the way he worked, of course, and not in his selection of victims. He had to be stopped, certainly, no question. Those poor hookers. Still, the need for cold. So very interesting to explore sometime, find a nice, dark, narrow place. Narrow, where had that come from? My dream, naturally. But that was just saying that my unconscious wanted me to think about it, wasn't it? And narrow felt right somehow, cold and narrow. Refrigerated truck, I said. I opened my eyes. Deborah struggled mightily with a mouthful of eggs before she could speak.
What?
Oh, just a guess. Not a real insight, I'm afraid, but wouldn't it make sense?
Wouldn't what make sense? She asked.
I looked down at my plate and frowned, trying to picture how this would work. He wants a cold environment to slow the blood flow, and because it's, cleaner.
If you say so.
I do say so, and it has to be a narrow space.
Why? Where the hell did that come from? Narrow.
I chose not to hear that question. So a refrigerated truck would fit those conditions, and it's mobile, which makes it much easier to dump the garbage afterward.
Deborah took a bite of bagel and thought for a moment while she chewed.
So, she said at last, and swallowed. The killer might have access to one of these trucks, or own one?
Maybe.
Except the kill last night was the first that showed signs of cold.
Deborah frowned. So he went out and bought a truck?
Probably not. This is still experimental. It was probably an impulse to try cold. She nodded. And we would never get lucky enough that he drives one for a living or something, right? I gave her my happy shark smile.
Ah, Deb, how quick you are this morning.
No, I'm afraid our friend is much too smart to connect himself that way.
Deborah sipped her coffee, put the cup down, and leaned back.
So we're looking for a stolen refrigerator truck, she said at last.
I'm afraid so, I said.
But how many of those can there be in the last 48 hours?
In Miami? She snorted. Somebody steals one, word gets out that it's worth stealing, and suddenly every goddamn two-bit original gangsta, Marielito, crackhead, and junior wise guy has to steal one just to keep up.
Let's hope word isn't out yet, I said.
Deborah swallowed the last of her bagel.
I'll check, she said. And then she reached across the table and squeezed my hand.
I really appreciate this, she said.
She gave me a couple of seconds of a shy, hesitant smile.
But I worry about how you come up with this stuff, Dex. I just...
She looked down at the table and squeezed my hand again.
I squeezed back.
Leave the worrying to me, I said. You just find that truck.
Chapter 8
In theory, Metro's 72-hour meeting gives everyone enough time to get somewhere with a case, but is soon enough that the leads are still warm. And so, Monday morning, in a conference room on the second floor, the crack crime-fighting team led by the indomitable Detective Laguerta assembled once again for the 72-hour. I assembled with them. I got some looks and a few good-hearted remarks from the cops who knew me. Just simple, cheerful wit like, "Hey, blood boy, where's your squeegee?" Salt of the earth, these people, and soon my Deborah would be one of them. I felt proud and humble to be in the same room. Unfortunately, these feelings were not shared by all present.
"The fuck you doing here?" grunted Sergeant Doakes.
He was a very large black man with an injured air of permanent hostility. He had a cold ferocity to him that would certainly come in handy for somebody with my hobby. It was a shame we couldn't be friends. But for some reason, he hated all lab techs,
and for some additional reason, that had always meant especially Dexter. He also held the Metrodade record for the bench press, so he rated my political smile. "I just dropped in to listen, Sergeant," I told him. "Got no fucking call to be here," he said. "The fuck out of here."
"He can stay, Sergeant," Lagerta said. Doak scowled at her.
"The fuck for?"
"I don't want to make anybody unhappy," I said, edging for the door without any real conviction.
"It's perfectly all right," Lagerta said, with an actual smile for me. She turned to Doak.
"He can stay," she repeated.
"Give me the fucking creeps," Doak grumbled.
I began to appreciate the man's finer qualities. Of course I gave him the fucking creeps. The only real question was why he was the only one in a room filled with cops who had the insight to get the fucking creeps from my presence.
"Let's get started," Lagerta said, cracking her whip gently, leaving no room for doubt that she was in charge. Doak slouched back in his chair with a last scowl at me. The first part of the meeting was a matter of routine. Reports, political maneuvers, all the little things that make us human. Those of us who are human, anyway. Lagerta briefed the information officers on what they could and could not release to the press. Things they could release included a new glossy photo of Lagerta she'd made up for the occasion. It was serious and yet glamorous. Intense but refined. You could almost see her making lieutenant in that picture. If only Deborah had that kind of PR smarts. It took most of an hour before we got around to the actual murders. But finally, Lagerta asked for reports on the progress in finding her mystery witness. Nobody had anything to report. I tried hard to look surprised. Lagerta gave the group a frown of command.
"Come on, people," she said. "Somebody needs to find something here."
But nobody did. And there was a pause while the group studied their fingernails, the floor, the acoustic tiles in the ceiling. Deborah cleared her throat.
She said, and cleared her throat again. "I had an idea, a different idea, about trying something in a slightly different direction."
She said it like it was in quotation marks, and indeed it was. All my careful coaching couldn't make her sound natural when she said it, but she had at least stuck to my carefully worded, politically correct phrasing. Lagerta raised an artificially perfect eyebrow.
"An idea! Really?"
She made a face to show how surprised and delighted she was.
"Please, by all means, share it with us, Officer Officer Morgan."
Doak snickered, a delightful man. Deborah flushed, but slogged on.
The cell crystallization on the last victim. I'd like to check and see if any refrigerated trucks have been reported stolen in the last week or so."
Silence. Utter dumb silence. The silence of the cows. They didn't get it, the brickheads, and Deborah was not making them see it. She let the silence grow, a silence Lagerta milked with a pretty frown, a puzzled glance around the room to see if anybody else was following this, then a polite look at Deborah.
"Refrigerated trucks?" Lagerta said.
Deborah looked completely flustered, the poor child. This was not a girl who enjoyed public speaking.
"That's right," she said.
Lagerta let it hang, enjoying it.
"Mm-hmm," she said.
Deborah's face darkened, not a good sign. I cleared my throat, and when that didn't do any good, I coughed, loud enough to remind her to stay cool. She looked at me. So did Lagerta.
"Sorry," I said.
"I think I'm getting a cold." Could anyone really ask for a better brother?
The cold,
Deborah blurted, lunging at my lifeline.
"A refrigerated vehicle could probably cause that kind of tissue damage. And it's mobile, so he'd be harder to catch. And getting rid of the body would be a lot easier. So if one was stolen, a truck, refrigerated, that might give us a lead."
Well, that was most of it, and she did get it out there. One or two thoughtful frowns blossomed around the room. I could almost hear gears turning. But Lagerta just nodded.
"That's a very interesting thought, officer," she said.
She put just the slightest emphasis on the word officer to remind us all that this was a democracy where anybody could speak up, but really...
But I still believe that our best bet is to find the witness. We know he's out there. She smiled, a politically shy smile. Or she, she said, to show that she could be sharp. But somebody saw something. We know that from the evidence. So let's concentrate on that and leave grasping at straws for the guys in Broward, okay? She paused, waiting for a little chuckle to run around the room. But, Officer Morgan, I would appreciate your continued help talking to the hookers. They know you down there. My God, she was good. She had deflected anyone from possibly thinking about Deb's idea, put Deb in her place, and brought the team back together behind her with the joke about our rivalry with Broward County, all in a few simple words. I felt like applauding. Except, of course, that I was on poor Deborah's team, and she had just been flattened. Her mouth opened for a moment, then closed, and I watched her jaw muscles knot as she carefully pushed her face back into cop neutral. In its own way, a fine performance, but truly, not even in the same league as Lagertus. The rest of the meeting was uneventful. There was really nothing to talk about beyond what had been said. So very shortly after Lagerta's masterful put-down, the meeting broke up and we were in the hall again. "Damn her!" Deborah muttered under her breath. Damn her! Absolutely, I agreed. She glared at me. Thanks, bro, some help you were. I raised my eyebrows at her. But we agreed I would stay out of it, so you would get the credit. She snarled. Some credit. She made me look like an idiot. With absolute respect, sister dear, you met her halfway. Deborah looked at me, looked away, threw up her hands with disgust. What was I supposed to say? I'm not even on the team. I'm just there because the captain said they had to let me in. And he didn't say they had to listen to you, I said. And they don't. And they won't, Deborah said bitterly. Instead of getting me into homicide, this is going to kill my career. I'll die a meter maid, Dexter. There is a way out, Deb, I said, and the look she turned on me now was only about one-third hope. What? She said. I smiled at her, my most comforting, challenging, I'm not really a shark, smile. Find the truck, I said. It was 3 days before I heard from my dear foster sister again, a longish period for her to go without talking to me. She came into my office just after lunch on Thursday, looking sour. I found it, she said, and I didn't know what she meant. Found what, Deb? I asked. The fountain of grumpiness? The truck, she said. The refrigerated truck. But that's great news, I said. Why do you look like you're searching for somebody to slap? Because I am, she said, and flung 4 or 5 stapled pages onto my desk. Look at this. I picked it up and glanced at the top page. Oh, I said. How many altogether? 23, she said. In the last month, 23 refrigerator trucks have been reported stolen. The guys over on traffic say most of them turn up in canals, torched for the insurance money. Nobody pushes too hard to find them, so nobody's been pushing on these and nobody's going to. Welcome to Miami, I said. Deborah sighed and took the list back from me, slouching into my extra chair like she'd just lost all her bones. There's no way I can check them all, not by myself. It would take months. God damn it, Dex, she said. Now what do we do? I shook my head. I'm sorry, Deb, I said, but now we have to wait. That's it? Just wait? That's it, I said. And it was. For 2 more weeks, that was it. We waited. And then... Chapter 9. I woke up covered with sweat, not sure where I was, and absolutely certain that another murder was about to happen. Somewhere not so far away, he was searching for his next victim, sliding through the city like a shark around the reef. I was so certain I could almost hear the purr of the duct tape. He was out there, feeding his dark passenger, and it was talking to mine. And in my sleep I had been riding with him, a phantom remora in his great slow circles. I sat up in my own little bed and peeled away the twisted sheets.
The bedside clock said it was 3:14. 4 hours since I'd gone to bed, and I felt like I'd been slogging through the jungle the entire time with a piano on my back. I was sweaty, stiff, and stupid, unable to form any thoughts at all beyond the certainty that it was happening out there without me. Sleep was gone for the night, no question. I turned on the light. My hands were clammy and trembling. I wiped them on the sheet, but that didn't help. The sheets were just as wet. I stumbled into the bathroom to wash my hands. I held them under the running water. The tap let out a stream that was warm, room temperature, and for a moment I was washing my hands in blood and the water turned red. Just for a second, in the half-light of the bathroom, the sink ran blood red. I closed my eyes. The world shifted. I had meant to get rid of this trick of light in my half-sleeping brain. Close the eyes, open them, the illusion would be over, and it would be simple, clean water in my sink. Instead, it was like closing my eyes had opened a second set of eyes into another world. I was back in my dream, floating like a knife blade above the lights of Biscayne Boulevard, flying cold and sharp and homing in on my target, and I opened my eyes again. The water was just water. But what was I? I shook my head violently. Steady, old boy. No Dexter off the deep end, please. I took a long breath and peeked at myself. In the mirror, I looked the way I was supposed to look. Carefully composed features, calm and mocking blue eyes, a perfect imitation of human life. Except that my hair stuck up like Stan Laurel's, there was no sign of whatever it was that had just zipped through my half-sleeping brain and rattled me out of my slumber. I carefully closed my eyes again. Darkness. Plain, simple, darkness. No flying, no blood, no city lights. Just good old Dexter with his eyes closed in front of the mirror. I opened them again. Hello, dear boy. So good to have you back. But where on earth have you been? That, of course, was the question. I have spent most of my life untroubled by dreams and, for that matter, hallucinations. No visions of the apocalypse for me. No troubling Jungian icons burbling up from my subconscious. No mysterious recurring images drifting through the history of my unconsciousness. Nothing ever goes bump in Dexter's night. When I go to sleep, all of me sleeps. So, what had just happened? Why were these pictures appearing to me? I splashed water on my face and pushed my hair down. That did not, of course, answer the question, but it made me feel a little better. How bad could things be if my hair was neat? In truth, I did not know. Things could be plenty bad. I might be losing all, or many, of my marbles. What if I had been slipping into insanity a piece at a time for years, and this new killer had simply triggered the final headlong fall into complete craziness? How could I hope to measure the relative sanity of somebody like me? The images had looked and felt so real. But they couldn't be. I had been right here in my bed. Yet I had almost been able to smell the tang of salt water, exhaust, and cheap perfume floating over Biscayne Boulevard. Completely real. And wasn't that one of the signs of insanity, that the delusions were indistinguishable from reality? I had no answers, and no way to find any. Talking to a shrink was out of the question, of course. I would frighten the poor thing to death, and he might feel honor-bound to have me locked away somewhere. Certainly I could not argue with the wisdom of that idea, but if I was losing my hold on sanity as I had built it, it was all my problem. And the first part of the problem was that there was no way to know for sure. Although, come to think of it, there was one way. 10 minutes later, I was driving past Dinner Key. I drove slowly, since I didn't actually know what I was looking for. This part of the city slept, as much as it ever did. A few people still swirled across the Miami landscape. Tourists who'd had too much Cuban coffee and couldn't sleep. People from Iowa looking for a gas station, foreigners looking for South Beach. And the predators, of course. Thugs, robbers, crackheads, vampires, ghouls, and assorted monsters like me. But in this area, at this time, very few of them altogether. This was Miami deserted, as deserted as it got, a place made lonely by the ghost of the daytime crowd. It was a city that had whittled itself down to a mere hunting ground, without the gaudy disguises of sunlight and bright T-shirts. And so I hunted. The other night eyes tracked me and dismissed me as I passed without slowing. I drove north, over the old drawbridge, through downtown Miami, still not sure what I was looking for, and still not seeing it. And yet, for some uncomfortable reason, absolutely sure that I would find it, that I was going in the right direction, that it was waiting for me ahead. Just beyond the Omni, the nightlife picked up. More activity, more things to see. Whooping on the sidewalks, tinny music coming and going through the car windows. The night girls came out, flocks of them on the street corners, giggling with each other, or staring stupidly at the passing cars. And the cars slowed to stare back, gawking at the costumes and what they left uncovered. Two blocks ahead of me, a new Corniche stopped, and a pack of the girls flew out of the shadows, off the sidewalk, and into the street, surrounding the car immediately. Traffic stumbled to a half stop, horns blattered. Most of the drivers sat for a minute, content to watch, but an impatient truck pulled around the knot of cars and into the oncoming lane. A refrigerator truck. This was nothing, I said to myself. Nighttime yogurt delivery. Pork link sausages for breakfast, freshness guaranteed. A load of grouper headed north or to the airport. Refrigerated trucks moved through Miami around the clock, even now, even in the night hours. This it was, and nothing more. But I put my foot down on the gas pedal anyway. I moved up, in and out of traffic. I got within three cars of the Corniche and its besieged driver. Traffic stopped. I looked ahead at the truck. It was running straight up Biscayne, moving into a series of traffic lights. I would lose him if I got too far behind, and I suddenly wanted very badly not to lose him. I waited for a gap in traffic and quickly nosed out into the oncoming lane. I was around the Corniche and then speeding up, closing on the truck, trying not to move too fast, not to be conspicuous, but slowly closing the space between us. He was three traffic lights ahead, then two. Then his light turned red, and before I could gloat and catch up, mine did too. I stopped. I realized with some surprise that I was chewing on my lip. I was tense. Me, Dexter the Ice Cube. I was feeling human anxiety, desperation, actual emotional distress. I wanted to catch up to this truck and see for myself. Oh, how I wanted to put my hand on the truck, open the door to the cabin, look inside. And then what? Arrest him single-handed? Take him by the hand to dear Detective Laguerta? See what I caught? Can I keep him? It was just as likely that he would keep me. He was in full hunting mode, and I was merely tagging along behind like an unwanted little brother. And why was I tagging along? Did I just want to prove to myself that it was him, the him, that he was out here prowling and I was not crazy? And if I was not crazy, how had I known? What was going on in my brain? Perhaps crazy would be a happier solution after all. An old man shuffled in front of my car, crossing the street with incredibly slow and painful steps. For a moment I watched him, marveling at what life must be like when you move that slow, and then I glanced ahead at the refrigerator truck. His light had turned green. Mine had not. The truck accelerated quickly, moving north at the upper end of the speed limit, taillights growing smaller as I watched, waiting for my light to change, which it refused to do. And so, grinding my teeth, steady Dex, I ran the light, narrowly missing the old man. He didn't look up or break step. The speed limit on this stretch of Biscayne Boulevard was 35. In Miami, that means if you go under 50, they will run you off the road. I pushed up to 65, moving through the sparse traffic, desperate now to close the distance. The lights of the truck winked out as he went around a curve, or had he turned. I moved up to 75 and roared past the turn for the 79th Street Causeway, around the bend by the Publix Market, and into the straightaway searching frantically for the truck. And saw it. There, ahead of me, moving toward me. The bastard had doubled back. Did he feel me on his tail? Smell my exhaust drifting up to him? No matter, it was him, the same truck, no question. And as I raced past him, he turned out onto the causeway. I squealed into a mall parking lot and slowed, turning the car and accelerating back out onto Biscayne Boulevard, southbound now. Less than a block, and I turned onto the causeway too, far, far in front, nearly to the first bridge. I saw the small red lights winking, mocking me. My foot crashed down on the gas pedal, and I charged ahead. He was on the upslope of the bridge now, picking up speed, keeping the distance steady between us, which meant he must know, must realize somebody was following. I pushed my car a little harder. I got closer, little by little, a few lengths closer. And then he was gone, over the hump at the top of the bridge and down the far side, heading much too fast into North Bay Village. It was a heavily patrolled area. If he went too fast, he would be seen and pulled over. And then... I was up the bridge and onto the hump now, and below me... nothing. Empty road. I slowed, looking in all directions from the vantage point at the top of the bridge. A car moved toward me. Not the truck, just a Mercury Marquis with one smashed fender. I started down the far side of the bridge. At the bottom of the bridge, North Bay Village split off the causeway into two residential areas. Behind a gas station on the left, a row of condos and apartments made a slow circle. To the right were houses, small but expensive. Nothing moved on either side. There were no lights showing, no sign of anything, neither traffic nor life. Slowly I moved through the village. Empty. He was gone. On an island with only one through street. He had lost me. But how? I circled back, pulled off onto the shoulder of the road and closed my eyes. I don't know why. Perhaps I hoped I might see something again. But I didn't. Just darkness and little bright lights dancing on the inside of my eyelids. I was tired. I felt stupid. Yes, me. Ditzy Dexter trying to be Boy Wonder, using my great psychic powers to track down the evil genius, pursuing him in my supercharged crime-fighting vehicle. And in all likelihood, he was simply a stoked-up delivery boy playing macho head games with the only other driver on the road that night. A Miami thing that happened every day to every driver in our fair city. Chase me, you can't catch me. Then the uplifted finger, the waved gun, ho-hum, and back to work. Just a refrigerated truck, nothing more, now speeding away across Miami Beach, with the heavy metal station ripping from the radio speaker. And not my killer, not some mysterious bond pulling me out of bed and across the city in the dead of night, because that was just too silly for words, and far too silly for level-headed, empty-hearted Dexter. I let my head drop onto the steering wheel. How wonderful to have such an authentic human experience. Now I knew what it was like to feel like a total idiot. I could hear the bell on the drawbridge in the near distance clanging its warning that the bridge was about to go up. Ding, 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 the alarm bell on my expired intellect. I yawned. Time to go home, go back to bed. Behind me, an engine started. I glanced back. From behind the gas station at the foot of the bridge, he came out fast in a tight circle. He passed me fishtailing and still accelerating, and through the blur of motion in the driver's window, a shape spun at me, wild and hard. I ducked. Something thumped into the side of my car, leaving behind it the sound of an expensive dent. I waited for a moment just to be safe. Then I raised my head and looked. The truck was speeding away, crashing the wooden barrier at the drawbridge and powering through, leaping across the bridge as it started to raise up, and making it easily to the other side as the bridge keeper leaned out and yelled. Then the truck was gone, down the far side of the bridge and back into Miami, far away on the other side of the widening gap as the bridge went up. Gone, hopelessly gone, gone as if he had never been. And I would never know if it had been my killer, or just another normal Miami jerk.
I got out of my car to look at the dent. It was a big one. I looked around to see what he had thrown. It had rolled 10 or 15 feet away and wobbled out into the middle of the street. Even from this distance there was no mistaking it, but just to make sure I was absolutely without any doubt, the headlights from an oncoming car lit it up. The car swerved and smashed into a hedge, and over the sound of its now constant horn I could hear the driver screaming. I walked over to the thing to be sure. Yes, indeed, that's what it was. A woman's head. I bent to look. It was a very clean cut, very nice work. There was almost no blood around the lip of the wound. Thank God, I said, and I realized I was smiling. And why not? Wasn't it nice? I wasn't crazy after all.
Chapter 10. At a little after 8 a.m., Lagerta came over to where I was sitting on the trunk of my car. She leaned her tailored haunch onto the car and slid over until our thighs were touching. I waited for her to say something, but she didn't seem to have any words for the occasion. Neither did I. So I sat there for several minutes looking back at the bridge, feeling the heat of her leg against mine, and wondering where my shy friend had gone with his truck. But I was yanked out of my quiet daydream by a pressure on my thigh. I looked down at my pants leg. Lagerta was kneading my thigh as if it were a lump of dough. I looked up at her face. She looked back. "They found the body," she said. "You know, the rest of it that goes with the head." I stood up. "Where?" She looked at me the way a cop looks at somebody who finds corpseless heads in the street. But she answered. "Office Depot Center," she said. "Where the Panthers play?" I asked, and a little icy-fingered jolt ran through me. "On the ice?" Lagerta nodded, still watching me. "The hockey team," she said. "Is that the Panthers?" "I think that's what they're called," I said. I couldn't help myself. She pursed her lips. "They found it stuffed into the goalie's net." "Visitors are home," I asked. She blinked. "Does that make a difference?" I shook my head. "Just a joke, detective." "Because I don't know how to tell the difference. I should guess somebody there who knows about hockey," she said, her eyes finally drifting away from me and across the crowd, searching for somebody carrying a puck. "I'm glad you can make a joke about it," she added. "What's a..." She frowned, trying to remember. "A samboli." "A what?" She shrugged. "Some kind of machine. They use it on the ice." "A zamboni?" "Whatever. The guy who drives it. He takes it out on the ice to get ready for practice this morning. A couple of the players, they like to get there early, and they like the ice fresh. So this guy, the..." She hesitated slightly. "The samboli driver? He comes in early on practice days. And so he drives this thing out onto the ice, and he sees these packages stacked up down there in the goalie's net, so he gets down and he takes a look." She shrugged again. "Dokes is over there now. He says they can't get the guy to calm down enough to say any more than that." "I know a little about hockey," I said. She looked at me again with somewhat heavy eyes. "So much I don't know about you, Dexter. You play hockey?" "No, I never played," I said modestly. "I went to a few games." She didn't say anything, and I had to bite my lip to keep from blathering on. In truth, Rita had season tickets for the Florida Panthers, and I had found to my very great surprise that I liked hockey. It was not merely the frantic, cheerfully homicidal mayhem I enjoyed. There was something about sitting in the huge, cool hall that I found relaxing, and I would happily have gone there even to watch golf. In truth, I would have said anything to make Lagerta take me to the rink. I wanted to go to the arena very badly. I wanted to see this body stacked in the net on the ice more than anything else I could think of. Wanted to undo the neat wrapping and see the clean, dry flesh. I wanted to see it so much that I felt like a cartoon of a dog on point. Wanted to be there with it so much that I felt self-righteous and possessive about the body. "All right," Lagerta finally said, when I was about to vibrate out of my skin, and she showed a small, strange smile that was part official and part... what? Something else altogether. Something human, unfortunately, putting it beyond my understanding. Give us a chance to talk.
I'd like that very much, I said, absolutely oozing charm. Lagerta didn't respond. Maybe she didn't hear me, not that it mattered. She was totally beyond any sense of sarcasm where her self-image was concerned. It was possible to hit her with the most horrible flattery in the world, and she would accept it as her due. I didn't really enjoy flattering her. There's no fun where there's no challenge. But I didn't know what else to say. What did she imagine we would talk about? She had already grilled me mercilessly when she first arrived on the scene. We had stood beside my poor dented car and watched the sun come up. She had looked out across the causeway and asked me 7 times if I had seen the driver of the truck, each time with a slightly different inflection, frowning in between questions. She'd asked me 5 times if I was sure it had been a refrigerated truck. I'm sure that was subtlety on her part. She wanted to ask about that one a lot more, but held back to avoid being obvious. She even forgot herself once and asked in Spanish. I told her I was seguro, and she had looked at me and touched my arm, but she did not ask again. And 3 times, she had looked up the incline of the bridge, shaken her head, and spat puta under her breath. Clearly that was a reference to Officer Puta, my dear sister Deborah. In the face of an actual refrigerator truck, as predicted by Deborah, a certain amount of spin control was going to be necessary, and I could tell by the way Lagerta nibbled at her lower lip that she was hard at work on the problem. I was quite sure she would come up with something uncomfortable for Deb. It was what she did best. But for the time being, I was hoping for a modest rise in my sister's stock. Not with Lagerta, of course, but one could hope that others might notice that her brilliant bit of attempted detective work had panned out. Oddly enough, Lagerta did not ask me what I had been doing driving around at that hour. Of course, I'm not a detective, but it did seem like a rather obvious question. Perhaps it would be unkind to say that the oversight was typical of her, but there it is. She just didn't ask. And yet there was more for us to talk about, apparently. So I followed her to her car, a big 2-year-old light blue Chevrolet that she drove on duty. After hours, she had a little BMW that nobody was supposed to know about. "Get in," she said, and I climbed into the neat blue front seat. Lagerta drove fast, in and out of traffic, and in a very few minutes we were over the causeway to the Miami side again, across Biscayne and a half mile or so to I-95. She drove onto the freeway and wove north, through traffic at speeds that seemed a little much even for Miami. But we got to 595 and turned west. She looked at me sideways, out of the corner of her eye, 3 times before she finally spoke. "That's a nice shirt," she said. I glanced down at my nice shirt. I had thrown it on to chase out of my apartment and saw it now for the first time, a polyester bowling shirt with bright red dragons on it. I had worn it all day at work, and it was a trifle ripe, but yes, more or less clean-looking. Somewhat nice, of course, but still. Was Lagerta making small talk, so I would relax enough to make some damaging admission? Did she suspect that I knew more than I was saying, and think she could get me to drop my guard and say it? "You always wear such nice clothes, Dexter," she said. She looked over at me with a huge, goofy smile, unaware that she was about to ram her car into a tanker truck. She looked back in time and turned the wheel with one finger, and we slid around the tanker and west on I-595. I thought about the nice clothes that I always wore. Well, of course I did. I took pride in being the best-dressed monster in Dade County. Yes, certainly he chopped up that nice Mr. Duarte, but he was so well-dressed. Proper clothing for all occasions. By the way, what did one wear to attend an early morning decapitation? A day-old bowling shirt and slacks, naturally. I was a la mode. But aside from this morning's hasty costume, I really was careful. It was one of Harry's lessons. Stay neat, dress nicely, avoid attention. But why should a politically minded homicide detective either notice or care? It was not as if... Or was it? A nasty little idea began to grow. Something in the strange smile that flicked across her face and then away gave me the answer.
It was ridiculous, but what else could it be? Lagerda was not looking for a way to put me off my guard and ask more penetrating questions about what I had seen, and she did not truly give a winged fart about my hockey expertise. Lagerda was being social. She liked me. Here I was, still trying to recover from the horrible shock of my bizarre, lurching, slobbering attack on Rita, and now this? Lagerda liked me? Had terrorists dumped something in the Miami water supply? Was I exuding some kind of strange pheromone? Had every woman in Miami suddenly realized how hopeless real men are, and I had become attractive by default? What, in all very seriousness, the hell was going on? Of course I could be wrong. I lunged at the thought like a barracuda at a shiny silver spoon. After all, what colossal egotism to think that a polished, sophisticated, career-track woman like Lagerda might show any kind of interest in me. Wasn't it more likely that what? As unfortunate as it was, it did make a kind of sense. We were in the same line of work, and therefore, conventional cop wisdom said, more likely to understand and forgive each other. Our relationship could survive her cop hours and stressful lifestyle. And although I take no credit for it, I am presentable enough. I clean up good, as we natives like to say. And I had put myself out to be charming to her for several years now. It had been purely political schmoozing, but she did not have to know that. I was good at being charming, one of my very few vanities. I had studied hard and practiced long, and when I applied myself, no one could tell I was faking it. I was really very good at sprinkling seeds of charm. Perhaps it was natural that the seeds would eventually sprout. But sprout into this? What now? Was she going to propose a quiet dinner some evening? Or a few hours of sweaty bliss at the Cacique Motel? Happily, we arrived at the arena just before panic took me over completely. Lagerda circled the building once, looking for the